Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Migrant City: Arrivals, Speculation, Eviction, and the History of Early Hong Kong. We're joined today by Cecilia Chu, who is an urban historian and associate professor in the School of Architecture at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Her works focus on the social and cultural processes that shape the forms of the built environment and their impacts on local communities. She's the author of the award-winning book, Building Colonial Hong Kong, Speculative Development and Segregation in the City, which received the 2023 Best Book in Non-North American Urban History Award from the Urban History Association and the 2024 International Planning Society Book Prize. Her other publications include The Speculative City, Emergent Forms and the Norms of the Built Environment by the University of Toronto Press in 2022 and Hong Kong Built Heritage by Hong Kong University Press, which is forthcoming in 2025. Welcome to the podcast, Cecilia.
Thank you, Romola, for inviting me. It's great to be here.
So I wanted to start by talking about your work on Hong Kong and this fantastic book that you have out. So I wanted to begin this conversation by asking if you could discuss how Hong Kong came to be a migrant city.
Well, thanks for the question. Hong Kong was founded primarily as a British imperial outpost to facilitate trade with China in the 1840s. And despite the now well-known success story that associated with the colony's economic prosperity later in the 19th century, Hong Kong actually had a very uncertain beginning, which has much to do with migration. So in the very beginning, the British were very much aware that as a non-settler colony with a very small European population, Hong Kong's vitality would always depend on the presence of Chinese capital. By attracting those with money from the mainland to trade and invest on properties, the government hoped to create a stable settlements and over time establish a kind of social contract between the colonial state and its native subjects. But the effort to attract well-off Chinese migrants were not very successful, at least in the first 10, 15 years or so, for several related reasons. One was a prolonged recession in the 1840s, coupled with consecutive epidemic outbreaks that devastated the economy. There were also competitions coming from other treaty ports in the region. And at one point, the British were even thinking of abandoning Hong Kong altogether. But a very important factor behind the failure to attract Chinese investors was the decisions of the British to co-opt with the so-called shady characters, including the many pirates operating across the South China Sea, to help them with their military campaigns against China. A majority of these people were Tangkas, also known as the boat people, which was a minority ethnic group seen as outsiders by the dominant Han Chinese society. Because of their low social status, the Tangkas were very eager to collaborate with the British, and many would eventually become middlemen, supplying various services for the incoming colonists, such as transport, material supplies, and ship maintenance, etc. Some Tangka women also entered into relationships with Western men, which was a situation seen as taboo by the Han Chinese. So the Tangkas would have been the first point of contact with the Chinese for the incoming British, even though they were not considered Chinese. Eventually, many of them would be rewarded for their collaboration, such as getting large plots of land and trade monopolies, etc. and in time, some would become very wealthy through land and property investment. But their involvement with triad groups also encouraged corruption, a situation that continued to deter the so-called proper or respectable Chinese to come to Hong Kong. The situation began to change in the 1850s after the Taiping Revolution, when more migrants from different backgrounds fled to Hong Kong to escape political unrest. Although this influx started to change the social makeup of Hong Kong, it's important to say that by this time, many Tangkas and other sojourners of lowly origins had already established themselves in a colony. This created a strong belief amongst the new migrants that Hong Kong was a unique land of opportunity where it was possible for anyone to make it regardless of their class.
This is a really interesting story, and obviously one that's driven by a kind of a dream of getting rich. And I'm wondering whether you can talk to us about how this particular dream of becoming wealthy perpetuated inequality amongst the migrants?
Well, the situation created a kind of irony that this belief in dreaming to become rich, in upward mobility, that is, you can become wealthy and successful by participating in the colonial economy, also allowed many migrants to become more tolerant of exploitation and bad living conditions. This complicates our normative understanding of colonial power relations based on this assumed dichotomy between the European colonizers and the colonized natives. A more careful study of early Hong Kong, which, you know, in my book discuss a bit about that, would reveal that there were many divisions among both the Europeans and the Chinese, even though there exists a real hierarchy between the two groups. And indeed, this upward mobility of the Tanka is interesting because it shows that it was made possible by a kind of triangulation, that their being rejected by the respectable Han Chinese became a motivation for them to collaborate with the British and Europeans. One can argue that it was these people who played a crucial role in enabling the success of colonization. Now, I wanted to make one more point about upward mobility, which is a phenomenon not uncommon in other migrant communities. But in Hong Kong, it was heightened by what I call a speculative economy, where it was possible for anyone to get rich very quickly by investing on housing property, thanks to a housing policy that encouraged speculation by restricting land supply to boost fiscal reserves. Under the so-called Highland price system, the most favored type of investment was what we call the Tonglao, or Chinese tenements, because these buildings could be legally subdivided and thereby fetch higher rents. Most investors with capital would prefer to invest on these properties, which came to accommodate hundreds of thousands of poor Chinese migrant workers.
I was just wondering then, in following up on that question about these tenement housing, what the living conditions were like for these migrants in early Hong Kong.
But the living conditions of the Chinese tenements were quite bad. Most of these were overcrowded, and there were very frequent outbreaks of diseases. But as I said earlier, many migrants living there saw their situations to be just transitional, as they dreamed of moving out of poverty and one day becoming part of the property-owning elite. Another point to mention is that although these buildings were called Chinese tenements, the patterns of ownership were very mixed, including not only Chinese, but many Europeans, Indians, Parsis, and other people with capital. This also created a class of so-called rentier lords who profiteered by renting a floor in the tenements and subletting it to poor workers. These ownership patterns were revealed in a property listing of the Chinese district named Taiping Shan after a major plague outbreak in 1894. The revelation prompted some social critics to condemn the rampant and unethical profiteering practices, whilst also accusing the government for failing to improve the housing conditions. It's also interesting to note that as the government tried to impose stricter building regulations to improve the housing conditions, Chinese and probably European owners would often band together to resist these laws, claiming that they violated the laissez-faire housing markets that was the foundation of the colonial economy. The Chinese landowners even wrote a joint letter to the colonial office in London, threatening that they would pull out their investment out of Hong Kong if the government insisted on imposing these anti-market rules. The point here is that one can see the emergence of a certain kind of moral economy at work by the late 19th century. The government was expected to ensure the proper functioning of a colonial capitalist economy in which the Chinese were key players. In exchange, these Chinese would help strengthen the legitimacy of the colonial state. This is not to say that they would support all of his policies or that there were no tensions at all. In fact, there were many. But in a general sense, the Chinese had over time become more able to exercise their economic power. They also learned to work with different constituencies in different situations to their benefit. So their relationships with the state, with the Europeans, and with their own fellow countrymen were very complex.
So I wanted to come to a point that you mentioned in this previous discussion, which is about other migrants and also about Europeans in that point. And I wanted to just ask you to elaborate on that and just talk us through how they lived, given that many of them had also migrated into Hong Kong.
Sure, I think that's an important question. For those who are familiar with Hong Kong's history would know of the existence of a European reservation district, which sat at the mountaintop of Hong Kong Island. Like many other colonies at the time, residence in the reservation was exclusive to Europeans, based on the rationale that because Europeans were not used to the hot weather of the tropic, they needed to live on higher grounds in order to protect their health and well-being. But not all Europeans were able to afford living at the expensive residences at the peak. And these include many Portuguese, who were mostly migrants from neighboring Macau, working as clerks in European trading companies. And by the late 19th century, many of them were living in an area called Mid-Levels, which was just outside the European reservation on Hong Kong Island. At this time, a new wave of wealthy Chinese migrants were looking for properties to invest and began to buy up more and more houses across the colony. This caused a growing number of Portuguese being evicted from their homes at the mid-levels. And out of desperation, they petitioned the government to protect the housing right of poor Europeans by granting them land to establish their own reservation. This is also reservation by race, and in this case, for Portuguese only. This idea of the plight of the poor whites actually followed a familiar storyline of Hong Kong. That is, the colonial system was seen to have unjustly benefited the Chinese more than the British and Europeans. These narratives contributed to a sense of injustice and even solidarity among some of the Europeans who were not part of the elite white population. What's really interesting also is that segregation by race and ethnicity was seen as a corrective to the colonial housing system. That is, it would prevent outside speculators from raising rent for profiteering purpose. Even many Chinese came to support the arrangement, insofar they could also establish their own segregated areas. But many of these proposals did not work out, mainly because they proved to be economically unsustainable, that property owners were unable to sell their assets during recessions.
I wanted to sort of ask in parallel then, again, going back to one of the points that you made earlier, and I'm thinking back to the discussion on the tenement housing for working class Chinese, and we talked about the living conditions at that time, but there's an eviction question there as well, isn't there? So I was wondering, again, if you could tell us a little bit about that history of evictions of the working class Chinese.
Sure. I think a good example is what happened in the early 1920s when Hong Kong went through an unprecedented land boom that further drove up rent and housing prices. This led to evictions all across the colony, affecting both European workers and Chinese laborers. The situation in turn led to new calls for the governments to intervene in the housing market in order to protect the working population. And interestingly, these calls began to differ from those earlier ones in two ways. One is that they focus less on the divide between Chinese and Europeans, as both were seen now as victims of speculation. Rather, the accusation pointed to outsiders, that is, the rich mainland migrants who were said to have little concern for Hong Kong's long-term interests. The second is that there was growing anger directed at large investment firms that were said to be complicit in speculation, and also at the government for failing to protect the so-called Hong Kong interest. These complaints can be seen in many letters published in local newspapers by people of different backgrounds. And clearly the letter took on a stronger moral tone, lashing out against unethical landlords and highlighting the sufferings shared by working class Europeans and Chinese. And it is in this context that the government, in a somewhat surprising move, went ahead and imposed the first rent control law, which prevented landlords from raising rents for a year and to dampen the speculative craze on existing properties. So by fashioning itself as a guardian of public goods, the government succeeded in preserving the colonial capitalist order, that is the land system that both provided the government with revenue as well as an attractive management environment for property owning elites. It must be said also that despite all their complaints made against high rents, most working class Chinese were not really against the colonial capitalist system per se. Unlike the more radical leftist writers in China at the time in the 1920s, calling for a revolution against the capitalist class, the arguments of the Hong Kong Chinese tended to make the case for protecting the livelihoods of workers as a way to maintain Hong Kong's economic status, which was also a condition that allowed them to make it one day, to claim a stake in a society, in a colonial context.
I think this is a really interesting story, and I'm beginning to sense that there's sort of an emergence of identity in Hong Kong. And I was wondering if you could comment on that, please.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. If we look at the popular writings in the 1920s, it's clear that there was a kind of emerging discourse of Hong Kong identity, which began to recognize the common interest and plights shared by different constituencies. They also suggest a stronger expectation of the government to protect the interest of longtime residents, regardless of their race and ethnicities. The problem was seen to be mostly caused by outsiders, that is, the wealthy mainland Chinese profiteers, with little interest in Hong Kong's welfare and therefore should not be entitled to the privileges enjoyed by the local people. Now, reading this narrative now is really intriguing because some of the claims seems to be quite similar to those made many decades later, especially after Hong Kong's economic takeoff in the post-war period. In that context, mainland Chinese migrants were seen even more so as outsiders, right? Because of the huge gaps in economic development between China and Hong Kong. And in fact, there were also many popular TV series depicting the scenarios in which mainland migrants were being discriminated upon in various ways. But then fast forward to the 2000s, the situation obviously changed. With China now becoming an economic powerhouse, many Hong Kong citizens, like back in the 1920s, were sensing the threats from wealthy mainland migrants, using up their resources and welfare provisions and taking up their jobs. Now, certainly, these scenarios are also happening in other parts of the world today. And the Hong Kong story is somewhat ironic in a sense that it is a story of migrants that continue to discriminate against other migrants. It also suggests that senses of identity and aspirations for good life are shaped by ongoing economic and political circumstances.
I think that's a really interesting story, and I wanted to just pick up on that last point you made about migrants discriminating against other migrants. I mean, this is such a fascinating history of different migrants making a particular place and Hong Kong becoming what it is today because of the migration of different groups of people. But also, as you talk about it, this history of speculation, very particular identity of free market and the workings of it in Hong Kong, that also lead to evictions of people. So we have migrations coming from outside, but also the sort of movements of people within Hong Kong as well as a result of evictions and speculation and so forth. You know, the displacement kind of takes on these different forms in the production of the city. And I think having that historical perspective is really important in kind of understanding, you know, how cities are what they are today. And your book has been hugely enjoyable to read as well from that perspective. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today to talk to us about your work, Cecilia. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Romola. It's a pleasure to be here.